United Astrology Congress presents Astrology of Midlife with Jim Lewis, recorded live from UAC 89, held July 13th through the 18th, 1989. We take you to the Fairmont Hotel in New Orleans, Louisiana, where the program is just now beginning.
Of course, all of you are undoubtedly looking forward to it, as am I, and have been for some time. How many here have Pluto in Leo? Yeah, just about everyone. I can see that this particular presentation has particularly appealed to those with Pluto in Leo. I can't imagine why. Perhaps it's because Pluto's presently going through Scorpio, which is one of the things we'll discuss as one of the attributes of our midlife transition. So what we're going to do today, and this is actually an all-day workshop, which I normally use, 6 or 7 hours for, condensed down into 45 minutes. So things are going to come fast and furious. I have 3 planets in Gemini, so you can be advised that you better have your notes tabs all ready, because here we go. The transition to midlife from youth is one which, of course, is a natural product of growth and aging. It's part of the things that happen when you're a human being on this planet and time passes, right? So it really shouldn't be a big deal. But in certain societies, and we'll probably talk more about them later on in the presentation, the archetype of youth is particularly emphasized. Jung described an archetype called the puer eternus, which is Latin for eternal boy, which actually its closest English language parallel is Peter Pan, who was the symbol of the I won't grow up, I won't be responsible, I won't do anything like that, right? And the archetype of the puer eternus is particularly powerful in Western civilization, and especially so in the United States. And so those of us who live in this country find that the archetype of youth is very insistent. It's extremely hard to let go of youth in the U.S. Everyone's supposed to look young and be young all the time. I come from California, where it's, of course, as you know, virtually an obsession. So, I mean, they now have special aftercare facilities for people who have had their plastic surgery, that you can go into a special place where the rooms are dark and there's no mirrors, so you don't see how it looks, right? And then in 4 or 5 days, like a butterfly emerging from the chrysalis, you're able to make it back onto Rodeo Drive and spend all your husband's money. So, So the concept of eternal youth and the puer eternus is an extremely important one in the U.S., and so we tend to see things in terms of either great age or youth, with nothing in between. And the midlife transition is, in fact, what is in between. Everybody makes a big deal of puberty in the U.S. Everyone says, oh boy, so-and-so's going through puberty. And you kind of get a 6 or 7 year dispensation between the ages of 13 and 20 where you can do just about anything you want. And everyone says, oh, it's okay, he or she is going through puberty. That's why they're acting so peculiar. And of course, it is really an extremely upsetting and far out thing to go from childhood into adolescence. Your body changes, your psyche changes, your hormones change, your relationship to society change, and your relationship to your family changes. Virtually everything changes. But what one doesn't understand is exactly the same things change with equal in intensity between the ages of 38 and 50. Exactly the same change. In fact, I refer to the midlife crisis as puberty in reverse. In fact, a lot of those things that happened in your teenage years, in fact, do go backwards. Some of the hormones do, some of the appearance does. A whole lot of things go backwards. So it's just as big a deal. It's just as difficult. But you don't get a 12-year breathing space. In fact, you're supposed to work even harder and be even more competent and even more together than you were before. So that it's really kind of unfair that the kids have this, teenage hiatus where they don't have to be responsible people. But when we go through just as big a change in going from youth into middle age, we don't get to, relax at all. So we're going to speak a lot about what we should do in order to accomplish successfully the midlife transition. Carl Jung, of course, is perhaps the progenitor of the very concept of a midlife transition. The way that people view things in Western civilization is what I call the steady state universe, where it's viewed by scientific reality that everything stays exactly the same unless it moves. Right, like the Descartesian view of reality is that everything stays the same unless something comes and pushes it. And this is the view of the human psyche and growth. You kind of get the idea. It's fading quickly, fortunately, but especially in the early part of this century, there's a powerful idea that you sort of grew up until you were 21, and then you were finished, right? You were mature. And then you stayed exactly the same until you were 65, after which time you began getting old, right? And that the ages between 21 and 65 were just adulthood, and it was all the same. And that's kind of a view that everyone sort of unconsciously holds psychologically, even though I'm sure you all realize it's completely inappropriate. But what really happens is that Jung described that growth and change go on throughout life, that there is constant change and constant growth. In fact, he had a phrase which I love to quote. It's sort of the beginning of all of my major presentations. Somewhere, Jung said, "Every part of the psyche seeks outer manifestation." And what he means by that is every part of the psyche, every part of your unconscious mind is striving to have outward expression in your life during some time. So this quote, "every part of the psyche seeks outer manifestation," is very appropriately translated into astrology's by saying every aspect of your horoscope or every planet in your chart seeks outward manifestation. And this has become the theme of just about all of my presentations. When I speak on astrocartography on Monday, I will speak about how your motions to different places, your traveling, are parts, are inner parts of your unconscious attempting to express themselves outwardly. Anyway, so back to the midlife crisis. Every part of the psyche seeks outer manifestation. As time and circumstances bring factors into consciousness, you learn and absorb and assimilate new parts of yourself and thus grow into a complete person. If you reject parts of yourself, parts of the psyche that are sort of attempting to bloom, then what happens? Well, Jung has another quote that says, if an inner situation is not made conscious, it happens outside as fate. That's, I think, a very, very important quote for astrologers to comprehend. If an inner situation is not made conscious, it happens outside as fate. So what this suggests is that if you do not assimilate and take into yourself the new emerging parts of your psyche, they're going to happen to you outside as things that happen to you, as accidents, as fate. And of course, that, of course, is true for the midlife transition. You know, different people react differently to the midlife crisis. Some, the more repressed a person is, the more parts of their psyche that are held down into unconsciousness, the more of a problem they're going to have during midlife, aren't they? Because these parts of the psyche are going to bubble up to the surface with, considerable disruptive possibility. Jung sort of described two halves of life. The first half, which we can say goes roughly from 0 to 40, more or less, is the half of the hero's journey, of building your ego, of slaying your dragons, of finding out who you are and going out into the world and tilting with your windmills and killing your monsters and rescuing your damsels and doing all the things that the hero does on the hero's journey. The second half of life is what Jung called life's afternoon. And this is a time when you draw back into yourself. He quotes somewhere about how the sun rises into the midheaven and then begins its decline into the west. And this is about the age of 40. This is the midlife transition that we're speaking of, that turning point where the sun seeks going upward, ceases to go upward in the sky and begins to start setting. And he says it's absolutely necessary to spend the second half of life not in trying to get more money and bigger cars and more status, because then suddenly the play is all over and all you have is a pile of money. I mean, what good is that, right? You can't, in fact, take it with you. So that you should spend the second half of life with harmonization and acceptance of reality. We'll speak certainly more of this as time goes on. But you draw back into yourself in life's afternoon. Jung himself did exactly this. Around the age of 40, he writes in his biography, which is called Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and from which much of this material is taken, he writes about how he was really glad he had his patients when he was 40 because they kept him straight. He would go into the office each day and his patients would sit there and tell him what was going on in Jung's psyche, because he was completely bananas. He was totally falling apart and he couldn't really do anything himself at all. He finally withdrew completely and moved to Bollingen, this little town on the shore of the Zurich Sea in Switzerland, and built a stone castle with his own hands as a symbol of the psyche that he was trying to create within. So, anyway, you can't take it with you. Egyptians used to put, you know, food and money into the sarcophagus with the mummy. Apparently, they did not know about the midlife transition. And Chinese used to bury phony counterfeit money with you so that you could pay people off on the other side. But we all know that this type of thing probably isn't going to work, and that some kind of coming to terms with yourself is going to be necessary for you to make it through the second half of life. And exactly what that coming to terms needs to be is what we're going to speak of for the rest of this morning. There are two books that I've drawn from largely in creating this presentation. One is by a Jungian named Murray Stein, S-T-E-I-N. It's called In Midlife. It was published by Spring Publications in 1983. And then the other is Jung's own Memories, Dreams, Reflections, which is his widely available autobiography. And it's obvious that Murray Stein himself drew a great deal from Jung. So these different stages and subdivisions of the midlife transition that I'm going to speak of come from, you know, either or both of those books. Stein describes three stages of the midlife transition. And the first stage is what he calls separation. And the separation is probably the most difficult and the most painful one. By the way, after we go through these stages as described by psychology, we'll then, of course, apply them astrologically and see if we can add to them. But in the stage of separation, which is usually the first stage, I should also say that these stages aren't always discrete and they don't always come in order. That is to say that you don't say, oh, this is my separation stage, and it goes until 4:15 on October 3rd, 1992, and then we'll get into the next stage. It isn't quite that simple. They're often merging together, and you alternate between one and the other. But anyway, the separation stage is usually the first stage, and this is what Stein calls the breakdown of the persona. Do you know what the persona is? The persona is the artificial, socially acceptable personality that you have created in order to present yourself to society. For instance, I'm Jim Lewis, I'm an astrologer, I created astrocartography, you all know who I am, right? Wrong. I am actually somebody else entirely who is inside this sort of role which I have created during my life. This role is my persona which I have created, and I have believed in it for a long time. In fact, what happens is that as a kid, you sort of know it's all nonsense, right? When you're 18 and 19 years old, you look at it and say, this is all BS. You know, these people walking around saying they're judges and authorities, and look at them, they're all the same as everybody else. And by the time that you actually get to be a judge or an astrologer or a lecturer or something else, you start actually believing in your own persona. You say, wait a minute, I am a judge. You know, I can send these people to 15 years at hard labor on a chain gang. Of course, I'm a really powerful, intelligent, wonderful person, aren't I? Okay, at the age of around 38 or 40, separation sets in, and this is the destruction of this whole persona. The psychosocial identity, as Erik Erikson calls it, begins to dissolve. And this is really a very painful process. After all, we've spent 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years building this persona. And all of a sudden, it's as if you had spent 30 years building a house, and then they come and say, I'm sorry, this is completely inappropriate. You have to tear the whole thing down, start all over again. Needless to say, it is painful. There will be, by the way, symbols of this that are very definite when it is happening. Things like losing your identification, either actually doing so or dreaming about losing your wallet, trying to find your pocketbook, your passport, some symbol of identity. At an astrological conference that I went to about 4 years ago when I was in the throes of separation, someone stole my jacket. Off of a chair. I thought, my jacket, you know, my outer identity. But the best one was that I had a dream where I was in a doctor's office and he told me very seriously, well, young man, you're going to have eye surgery. And I thought, eye surgery. And then I thought, wait a minute, he means eye surgery as in capital I, me surgery, right? Cutting off a piece of my eye. So you spend a lot of time creating this psychosocial identity, a whole lot of time creating this outer persona, and at the stage of separation, you separate from it, and you find out that, in fact, that is no longer appropriate for you and that you have to, in some way, abandon it. The separation can lead to two or three reactions, or common reactions. One is the greatest danger for a midlife transition, which is what I call defensive restructuring. Defensive restructuring is what happens when all of the signs and all of your own intelligence and everything that you're aware of points to the destruction and recreation of your own persona and personality. But instead of saying, okay, I have to do it, you say, wait a minute. We will stick the leaves back on the trees, right? We will somehow get back to youth. We will not let this happen. We're going to prevent this from happening, right? I think that, by the way, societies, and this is going to be a part that I'm not sure that I get to, societies go through their own midlife crises, and especially when, as in our case, we have a large generation. The Pluto and Leo generation comprises 60 million Americans, a very large proportion of the whole. And all of us are going through our midlife transition at about the same time. So needless, the whole society is going through its midlife transition at the same time. And defensive restructuring can really be seen very clearly in the political arena. People like, for instance, dare I say, Ronald Reagan. I mean, an old-fashioned conservative, a 75-year-old man who's pretending to be a young man and saying, well, we can stick all the leaves back on the trees. It's morning in America. It's not afternoon. It's morning. We can have everything. You can have it all, et cetera, et cetera. I don't have to point out the contradictions of his reality, I'm sure. But I think what Jung said is that if you take easy philosophical answers, this is important, if you take easy philosophical answers to the problems of midlife, then there comes a dogmatism and a rigidity. Astrologers have sort of a great danger because we have this wonderful structure that says, okay, we can understand what's going on in the world. There, it'll be less noisy.
Excuse me for interrupting. Is there a Phyllis Mandala here? If any of y'all see her, would you send her to the hospitality desk? We've got a message from her. And that's all of my apologies.
Okay. So that there's a necessity for... I was saying that astrologers have a particular problem because we have this wonderful philosophical structure and we can harden and rigidify ourselves into a view of the world which completely comprehends everything and leaves no room for growth or change. So that if in the process of separation you find yourself being drawn to the Moonies or the fundamentalist Christians or the astrologers or some group that insists they have all the answers, beware. Because you are not supposed to go and immediately find a new firm structure for yourself. Instead, you are supposed to go into the second stage, which we are about to get to. The second thing that occurs during the separation is what Stein calls the journey to the depth of self. And this is when you start taking in some of the things that you've always had outside of yourself. I started this presentation by saying that that there were that every part of the psyche seeks outer manifestation, that you attempt to try to take into yourself all of the things that were outside of yourself. I then added that if an inner situation is not made conscious, it happens outside as fate. Okay, well, most of the things that are interesting to a person in the world are products of parts of their psyche that have been projected outward into the world. For instance, when you see a person of the opposite sex, or perhaps the same sex, walking by, and they really look good to you, and your eyes sort of involuntarily follow them as they walk by, this is really a part of yourself. This is the opposite sex part of yourself, the anima or the animus of yourself outside of you that is drawing your attention. And what happens during separation is that some of that energy comes back into yourself. Sometimes people will absolutely freak out when they see a limousine driving by, the representation of a lot of money. They'll see this ridiculous long car drive by and they'll think, boy, I'd do anything to have one of those, right? Or a big house in the suburbs or something like that. And those things are things that have your energy. They have absorbed your energy. Your eros is directed outward onto those objects. And in fact, in midlife, some of that energy starts coming back if you're doing it right. And those outer things seem less interesting and the inner things seem more interesting. Anyway, so assuming that you get through the stage of separation, which is the destruction of the old personality, you then come into a stage which Murray Stein has identified as liminality. Now, Murray Stein is not a very good writer, so if you get this book, you'll find that he uses the word liminality about 15 times in the first chapter, and you think, liminality? What is this man talking about? And then finally, in the third chapter somewhere, he defines it for you and admits that he made the word up himself. It comes from the Greek, limnos, which means shore, and liminality means sort of borderline-ness, or being on the edge of something new. So it's kind of borderliness. It's the ego separated from the fixed state of who it has been. And once it is separated, you drift. Jung says in his autobiography, "It was during this period that I was drifting like a rudderless ship." And so you are drifting like a rudderless ship. And there you are. You have separated from who you are, and you haven't attached to anything new. That's the important thing, is that once you separate, you don't immediately attach yourself to some group or some organization or some philosophy. You have to go through a period of drifting. And during this time, which Stein calls liminality, you don't know where you're going. And of course, this is really painful. Because you've always known exactly where you were going and why, and all of a sudden you're drifting around without any particular reason. During this time, a whole lot of different things occur. But let's see, I have a quote from Jung about this. He said, this occurred with him, by the way, when he parted with Sigmund Freud. His separation was his parting with Sigmund Freud. Because Freud had said, okay, you're going to come and be a great psychologist. You know, I am the world's greatest. I invented psychology, said Freud, and you are my first protege, so you will inherit the kingdom of psychology. Very Saturnian, very rigid. And Jung went through his midlife transition and broke with Freud, which was an amazingly courageous thing to do, because, I mean, he had it all set up, right? He was going to be the heir apparent to the entire science of psychology. He said, wait a minute, I don't think you're doing some things right. So anyway, he wrote after this, he was in his stage of liminality when he was off in Bollingen building his castles, and he said, after the parting of the ways with Freud, a period of inner uncertainty began for me. It would be no exaggeration to call it a state of disorientation. I felt totally suspended in midair, for I had not yet found my own footing. How many of you feel this from time to time? Yes, really. Okay, so this is the stage of liminality. After you have separated from the psychosocial identity that you've been so busy building throughout your 20s and 30s, you start drifting like a rudderless ship, totally suspended in midair, for I had not yet found my own footing. Okay, during this period, various things happen. During a time that you're drifting around in Neptune land, various things happen. And one of them is what Stein calls the return of the repressed. There were certain things that I heard an aha over there. There were certain things, certain parts of yourself that you did not give a chance to develop. As you were growing up as a kid, you created certain realities and you said, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to take this path. And the road not taken, you've heard that phrase, the road not taken comes back to haunt you. The things that you did not do, the art you did not do, or the money you did not make, or the love affair you did not have, or the other various things that you didn't do, start coming up more and more in your mind during this period of liminality. And often it is attached to symbols of Mercury, of Hermes. Accidents that happen to you in your life tell you about the things you did not do. For instance, if someone steals your jacket, it might be pointing to an identity you didn't develop. If your plane is accidentally shunted to New Orleans or to Los Angeles or someplace, watch out for the accidents, because Hermes is the god of the crossroads, and you are at a crossroads when you are in liminality, and Hermes will guide you on the road that you should go. But if you insist on having constantly in your mind the idea of where you should be going and what you should be doing, then obviously you aren't going to get there, because you'll be going just along your own program. So the accidents that happen, the things that occur to you that you find most annoying, are perhaps the repressed parts of yourself returning and asking for their time, for their day in court, for their time on stage. So, we have the return of the repressed. This is a terrible trunk. The second thing that sometimes happens during this period is the urge towards soul mating. And I suppose some of you may have encountered that from time to time, too. The urge towards soul mating is a very interesting part of the midlife crisis, and it's the part that is best known in popular ideas and concepts. Have you heard of the movie Blue Angel, the old movie with the Marlene Dietrich? It's about a professor, a very staid, solid Jupiterian type, who suddenly in his midlife crisis falls in love with a showgirl. Okay, this is both the return of the repressed and the urge for soul mating occurring at the same time. There's a part of himself which, as a professor and a bourgeois and a very middle-class, middle-everything person, he had never chosen. So that is the return of the repressed, and it came back as an urge to soulmating, to finding his soulmate, his opposite self. And, of course, in popular concepts, this is the idea of the housewife who gets it on with her chiropractor, or the businessman who starts having an affair with his secretary. And it's all of this constant stuff that we see about, oh, they're going through their midlife crisis, that's why they're behaving like this.
The movie Ten?
I didn't see it, but I'll take your word for it. Yes, yes. No, as we'll get to when we get to the astrology there, these ages, this all occurs between the age usually of 38 and 50, all of these stages. And we'll see that they attach very easily to certain astrological concepts, which in fact do happen at certain times. So we'll be attaching ages to this later. So the urge for soul mating is, there's a lot of mythological stuff. I have about six examples here, but I'll just describe one. You have to realize that the Greek myths were not just entertainment. They were more than entertainment. And I think our entertainment is getting better because it's getting more like Greek myths. That is to say that the Greek myths were supposed to be guideposts for people on their way through life. That you had concepts that philosophers and very wise people had thought of for years and years and years, and that they were the concepts for certain things, certain patterns of life, for marriage, for child rearing, for every part of life was conceptualized by a myth. And Odysseus, the Odyssey, was, I believe, and many others believe as well, the concept of the midlife transition. After all, here's this guy who started out to fight a war, a real ego-centered hero's journey, masculine type of thing to do, right? He gets in his ship and he sails off to Troy and he fights in the war, right? And on his way back home, having succeeded in his life's task, which was fighting this war, suddenly his ship gets blown around and he goes and visits strange places, and it's like liminality. Here he is like a rudderless ship being blown all over the whole Mediterranean. Mediterranean and trying to get home. So that I think it's quite clear that the Odyssey is a symbol of, or is an allegory of, the entire midlife transition. And there is a part of the Odyssey, which we all read or some of us read in high school, I guess the older among us did, where Odysseus ends up on the island of Circe, and she seduces him, and they spend some time in bed, and meantime, his men have all been turned into pigs. This is a symbol. No. This is a symbol of the searching for soul mating, and there is an act of courage which happens, and yet at the same time, you aren't supposed to fall for this one either. Just like Odysseus was not supposed to do certain things, he had to avoid this and he had to watch out for that. It was okay for him to have his affair with Circe, but he should not have fallen into a pattern of thinking, this is security. This is what I want. I will hold on to this relationship and set up housekeeping on Circe's island with all these little pigs we have running around here. Because that would have been falling in, you know, that would have been not going through the next stage. So the soulmate is a stage of liminality, but it is not the end in itself. And it's okay to have that wonderful, intense affair, but you mustn't turn it into the rest of your life. In fact, it is supposedly during this time, as I said, that the symbols lose their power. And it's the retraction of interest in interests that have always been very erotic and very numinous for you. Symbols lose their libido, to use Freudian terms, or their numinosity, to use a Jungian term. That is to say, it stops being something that attracts your attention. All of a sudden, the idea of having a Mercedes is not all that important anymore. All of a sudden, the idea of having a beautiful teenage girlfriend or boyfriend is not that important anymore. And so that is a stage of this. A further thing that occurs during liminality is the battle of the Puer and the Senex. Now, the Puer is the concept of youth, and the Senex is the concept of age. They are symbolized roughly as Uranus and Saturn, or Mercury and Uranus, maybe, and Saturn. It's the concept of youth and age, and I don't have time to go into a whole lot of it, but you get this kind of, during this particular stage of liminality, you're wandering around, but you find that you really are fighting with your father. There is really a stage where you are pitted against the concept of Saturn. And this is a very positive stage because, well, imagine the situation I was describing with Jung, because this, of course, was precisely what was going on there. If he had simply accepted his psychological father, Freud, and said, okay, I'll just do everything you say, Dad, and when you die, I'll be the world's biggest and most important and well-paid psychologist, right? What would Jung have accomplished? He would have simply been a projection of Saturn, of Freud's own unfulfilled selfhood. So by attaching himself to a Saturn figure like that, he is losing the capacity to develop himself. By buying into the structures and patterns of Saturn, of Papa Freud, Jung is not allowing himself the ability to develop himself and reach outward. So there needs to be a battle between the Puer and the Senex. There needs to be a polarity established during which you say, okay, I am different from my father. As Jung said, I am different from Freud. And you go on from there and find out who in fact you are. So we have seen that there are, in these two stages, there are several different things. A separation is basically the separation of yourself from your psychosocial identity, or the previous ego creation that you've been building throughout your entire life. And the great danger there is defensive restructuring, that you're going to find yourself some philosophical structure to immediately jump into and say, okay, I can do that and I don't have to grow anymore. If you succeed in separating from your ego identity, you then go through a period of liminality, which is wandering through the ocean, being adrift in the sea of unknowingness, and then there are all these other things that can occur to you there. The third stage that occurs has a very long name, so I'll just abbreviate it down here, and that is the journey through Hades and reintegration. The journey through Hades and reintegration is, of course, taken from our allegory of the Odyssey. Because, as you might remember, or you probably don't, the furthest point that Odysseus got from anywhere that he was trying to go. Remember, he's gone to Troy to fight his war, to be his hero's journey, to do all that. Now, on the way back, he's blown across the whole Mediterranean, back and forth to Circe's island and the Cyclops and Scylla and Charybdis and all these great dangers, each of which symbolizes a danger of midlife transition. And he finally comes, finally, at the furthest point, he's told by somebody, well, you have to go to Hades itself. You have to sail your ship to Hades itself. And so this is the symbol of how far you get. You go to the absolute end of the world and into the land of the dead in order to understand your midlife transition. And this is what distinguishes a midlife transition from other transitions. Some of you who are aware psychologically have probably observed that these three stages apply to any life transition, to any significant change. There's always going to be separation from who you have been before, a period of drifting and uncertainty, and then reintegration. But as Stein says, and I will read a quote from his book, but the pivotal experience of the psychological change that unfolds in midlife and the element that most unmistakably declares its uniqueness and brings it to its deepest meaning is the lucid realization of death as life's personal fated conclusion. The chilling awareness of this fact grips a person's consciousness at midlife as it has not gripped it before, and the sense of an absolute limit to personal extension in time spreads into every corner of consciousness and affects everything it touches. While this realization is not by itself the ultimate goal of the soul's transmutations during midlife, it is a critical catalyst in the chemistry of reaching the goal. A critical catalyst in the chemistry of reaching the goal, and one that leaves traces of itself indissolubly bound into the final product of the transformational process. So what he is saying here is that the awareness of your personal death, cheerful thought, hey, it's only 10:30 in the morning and we're already talking about death. This process of death is the most important part of the midlife crisis, and it is the thing which distinguishes it from other crises. And this is what is symbolized by the journey to Hades. This is what is symbolized by the fact that Odysseus, in his furthest reach on his attempt to reach home, and of course we all know what home is, was blown into the very depths of hell itself. Does anyone remember what happened to Odysseus when he got to Hades? You didn't do your high school homework, did you? Very well.
No.
God, it seemed so boring at the time, didn't it? That didn't seem to have any relevance at all. Yeah.
Didn't he meet an old friend of his?
Well, he meets a lot of people, including his mother, by the way. He basically meets Tiresias. Tiresias is the old blind seer, the prophet, and he asks Tiresias various things. And he learns from Tiresias two things. And these are the very important things that you have to learn when you go to hell. Have some of you not been there yet? Has anyone not been to hell yet? Well, you'll soon go. After lunch, you can go to hell. But Tiresias suggests that he learn two things. First of all, he needs to learn his limitations. And secondly, he needs to learn his long-range life task. Okay, his limitations are things that Tiresias tells him. He says, okay, you're not very good at this, you aren't very good at that. And his life task is, he says, well, you're supposed to return home to Ithaca. And there you will have certain things you have to do. Now, you probably remember vaguely what the story is, right? He's gone away and his wife is staying at home at the loom and she's weaving every day and these suitors are eating all the food and hanging out and the whole trip, right? So anyway, there are three things that Tiresias describes to Odysseus as things that he must do. And these have very great symbolic significance for those of us who are going through this midlife crisis. He says, first of all, on the way back, you're going to hit an island which is populated with cattle, with the holy cattle of Apollo. This is so far out. I'll get to the sociological representation of this later. But so you're going to get to this island that has the holy cattle of Apollo. Don't mess with the holy cattle of Apollo, says Tiresias, right? You are not supposed to fool around with these cattle. Don't let your men touch them either, because they don't belong to you. They belong to the sun, right? Okay, the next thing you have to do is you're going to get home and you're going to find out that your house is a mess. Like your wife has all these suitors and things aren't getting done and they're eating your crops and drinking your wine and so forth and so on. So you have to clean up your own house. You have to get rid of these people who are parasitical to your life. Task number two. And the third task is perhaps the strangest of all. He said, okay, once you've done that, then you take up an oar. That is the kind of an oar that you row a boat with. You take up an oar and you find a place so far inland that someone stops you on the street and asks you why you are carrying a winnowing fan. So you take an oar and you carry it inland so far that you find a place where no one knows what it is or what it is for, namely a place where no one's heard of the ocean. And there you build a temple to Poseidon. Very interesting. What do these things mean? Why did he have to do these particular things? Well, let's just briefly go through. I think that the sociological correspondence of the cattle of Apollo is most interesting. Because, first of all, what he means by that is you learn to control your appetites. You learn to live within your means. You learn to control your appetites, and I don't know why that's doing that. Does anyone have any idea? Yeah. Oh, I'm near the speaker. Okay, good. All right. Move away from the speaker. Why didn't someone tell me before this? I thought it was me. Oh, that's much better. Okay, so I'm farther away. Okay, so you don't mess with the holy cattle of Apollo. The reasons are the symbolism of that is that you learn to control your appetites and you learn your limits as a person. So I think it's real interesting that at this very point the entire planet is endangered by the fact that they are cutting down the rainforests in Brazil in order to raise what? Cattle. And what is it that happens in Brazil is the sunlight is transformed into energy, is transformed into oxygen. So it occurred to me that this is perhaps exactly what our civilization is not doing. It is eating the holy cattle of Apollo. In fact, there's a McDonald's right around the corner, and there's one across the street from there. You can go in and have a rainforest burger. Did you know that it takes 9 square yards of rainforest to make one McDonald's hamburger? So think of that next time you stop in McDonald's with kids. 9 square yards of rainforest. It's only a scratch about this big. You know, it isn't that big, right? Just do it a billion times and see what happens. Okay, cleaning up your house sounds a little bit to me like the environment, doesn't it? Clean up your house, get rid of the parasites, start living within your means. These are certainly things that our society as a whole could learn how to do, as opposed to just individually. How about the oar and taking the oar inland? This one is the strangest one of all. What does it mean that you pick up an oar and you take it inland and you build a temple to Poseidon in a place where no one knows what the ocean is all about? Does anyone have any idea what that might be in terms of the personal midlife crisis? Yes?
Could that be akin to a saying I heard once, do not go where the path may lead, go instead where there is no path and leave the trail?
Do not go where the path may lead, go instead where there is no path. Yes, that's quite a lot of it. Do you have something to add?
Well, it was just a sense of going into completely unknown territory with what you know.
Going, exactly, that's exactly it, is to go into completely unknown territory. And the thing is that you have to realize is that Odysseus was being particularly perplexed by Poseidon. Poseidon was the god who was tormenting Odysseus and blowing him all over the ocean and not letting him get home. And so the oar is a symbol of Poseidon, since it's a thing that's only used with a sea. So what you do is you take a symbol of the very thing that has been perplexing you, the very thing that has been haunting you and making life difficult for you, and you build a temple to it. You find people who don't know about it, who aren't yet conscious of it, and you tell them about it. You say, all right, this is my torment. This is the god that has been tormenting me and blowing me around the ocean for 12 years, and I am building a temple to him so that you will know what he's like.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your cassette over at this time for side two.
That's exactly what I'm doing right now. So that's what happens on the journey through Hades, is that you go through Hades, you realize death. And when you realize death, those three things come to you in Hades through Tiresias, through perhaps revelation of some kind. The three things that you're supposed to do. And all of them are things that the U.S. or Western civilization as a whole would be really well advised to look to. Don't eat the cattle of McDonald's. I mean Apollo. Clean up your act, clean up your house, get rid of the toxins, and then find the very thing which has been tormenting you, the archetype, the mythological archetype that has been tormenting our society and driving it in the direction it has been driving, and go to the rest of the world and tell them about it. So perhaps that is what should be done, if I may, add my own ideas on that.
But what would you tell? What would the United States tell the rest of the world right now?
That's a very good idea, and that's the last thing that I come to in this thing, is what are the values that we have to share? Perhaps we'll actually get to that. So anyway, there are two halves of life. There's another book, by the way, by a man named Carlo Carotenuto, Carotenuto, and it's called The Vertical Labyrinth, and it's published by Inner City Books in Toronto, and it's also about a midlife transition of an artist, and it's quite interesting. It's called The Vertical Labyrinth. And in it, he describes the first and second halves of life. He says that extroverts do particularly well in the first half. I mean, you go out and you slay your dragons and you get your big cars and you sell lots of real estate and everything's always getting bigger and bigger, and it's wonderful, right? Until you come to the point where you realize that all this stuff isn't really working, that there is no center of personality, that everything, that all of these are trophies that you have outside of yourself, that they decay and that they change. And no matter how much money you have or how big your company is or how big your car is, that all of these things are going to change and decay, and there needs to be something more permanent and more real, or it's going to be constantly unsatisfying. The unconscious remains totally unconscious. That is, it's projected outward onto things, onto women, onto wonderful things that you want, and so forth and so on. In the second half of life, there's the harmonization of various parts. I call the second half of life the revenge of the nerds. This is when the introverts can actually get their own way, because this is the time when you are supposed to go within, when you suddenly realize that the ego is no longer the object of the world, but is a conscious protagonist, when you actually start acting out in the world that which you most truly are, where symbols lose their libido, their numinosity. And, of course, you know that individuation is a path and not a goal, a constant process of changing things. Polarizations evaporate. You can know that you're succeeding in your midlife transition if your polarizations evaporate. If you no longer think that it makes a lot of difference whether the Democrats or the Republicans are in office, that the opposites that you have always seen as being incredibly important, incredibly opposite, and incredibly vital, lose some of their energy, and that numinosity evaporates into the air. Another good book, by the way, as a guide to a midlife transition, is Dante's Inferno. Since he, of course, was in the middle of his life, and he descended into the center of hell, and all the things that he saw along the way were temptations to stop growing, temptations to get frozen in rigid and unproductive behavior. The questions often raised, I suppose it's in someone's mind here, all of the stuff that you've been describing sounds extremely masculine-oriented. That this is Jung and this is Murray Stein and these are male Jungians. And what about the women? Do they go through exactly the same process, or is it somewhat different? I think it is somewhat different. And unfortunately, the Jungians, who of course are the ones who seem to know most about this, don't write a great deal about women, as you may have noticed. They're starting to do better at that, but they don't. They tend to just sort of say, you know, he as the term that is supposed to embrace both he and she. There's a quote from Joseph Henderson, though, who is a Jungian in San Francisco, which describes what I think goes on during the feminine midlife transition, which is quite different in its own way from the male. He wrote, "As she grew to know herself better, she began to see that for a man, or the masculine trained mind in woman, life is something that has to be taken by storm as an act of heroic will. But for the woman to feel right about herself, life is best realized by a process of awakening." So there's a slightly different pattern here, which I think that you could almost adapt as a pattern for men and women. That in men, the midlife crisis is going to be Sturm und Drang. It's going to be a process of agony, of giving up, of intensity, a storming of the palace, a war against yourself. Where with women, it is more a process of awakening, where you become aware of things. You don't have as much to destroy. Of course, it depends on the type of woman and the type of life that she has led. If she has spent her whole life creating a career in the outer world, a persona that's very powerful, then that too will have to be destroyed. So this is why he says, or the masculine trained mind in woman. So, there's a good myth for women in their midlife transition, by the way, which is Psyche and Eros. And in that, it's sort of the Sleeping Beauty thing, the Beauty and the Beast. There's a lot of symbolism in women's mythology of sleeping and waking up, isn't it? And I think that the midlife transition for women is indeed symbolized by this process of waking up. Anyway, there were four tasks. I will not go through the whole thing about who Psyche was and the myth, but there were four tasks which are described extremely well in Jean Houston's book, The Search for the Beloved. And there were four tasks that Psyche had to do in order to become a complete person. Oh, one was she was given by Venus, who was being a real bitch at this point, a huge pile of mixed seeds, wheat and barley and lentils and all these things all mixed up, and she was told she had to separate them into separate piles before the end of the day. This, I believe, symbolizes discrimination. Because the woman tends to accept things as they are and say, yes, things are as they are and I will not try to change them. And so for the maturing mind of midlife woman, there is a necessity for the creation of the Virgo or discrimination faculty symbolized by sorting the grains of wheat. She had to gather the golden fleece, which is a very masculine energy symbol from Aries, from the wild rams of the sun, right? And so this is the assimilation of the sun. This is the assimilation of the sun-Mars attribute. She has to introject, to take in from outside her sun and Mars instead of constantly projecting them outward onto men in her life. She was then told she had to gather the water of life from the highest peak in the mountains, and an eagle came to her rescue. And this kind of shows that spirituality ideas allow her to reach into the realms of thought and the essential water of life. And then finally, she too had to go to the underworld. Psyche herself had to go to the underworld in order to fetch something for Aphrodite, and so we're again back at the journey to Hades and reintegration. So we have gone through a lot of stuff. I told you it was fast, and we've seen the three stages of the midlife transition: separation from the ego, a period of drifting and uncertainty, and finally a journey to Hades, which leads us to reintegration into our new self. And I think a real wonderful example of this process, or an example of the product of this process successfully navigated, is Joseph Campbell, who recently died. I mean, here is this lovely man who simply went through his whole thing, wrote the hero's journey when he was doing his hero thing, and then at the end of his life became sort of an arbiter, became a symbol of maturity and knowledge for the entire society. Shortly before he died, and it was only a few months, he made that incredible series, which when I saw it on American television, on primetime TV, I thought, wow, things really have changed. There is some hope. When I saw that series on American primetime TV, I thought perhaps the Pluto and Leo midlife transition of the United States as a collective entity has some hope of reintegration and success. And this was after the darkest period of Ronald Reagan, when it seemed that the only thing that anyone was trying to do was to glue the leaves back on the trees, and meanwhile cut down all the trees in the Amazon basin. And I think that we cannot underestimate the significance of the fact that Joseph Campbell appeared on American TV at the darkest hour of our midlife transition as a collective whole. I'll close this part before we get into the astrology with a quote from, in fact, it's the first six lines from Dante's Inferno, and they are, "Midway upon the journey of our life, I found that I was in a dusky wood, for the right path whence I had strayed was lost. Ah me, how hard a thing it is to tell the wildness of that rough and savage place, the very thought of which brings back my fear." And so you can see that he was on his midlife crisis. And I think that that kind of shows how an exploration of these concepts enriches the, literary concepts of the midlife transition that we have. Okay, let's go into some of the astrology of the midlife transition. We haven't mentioned a thing about this so far, so now we have a few minutes to do that. Of course, you all, I'm sure, have already thought, there are certain transits that occur to everyone during the midlife years. What are they? Uranus opposite Uranus. Don't forget Uranus opposite Uranus, right? How could you forget that? And what's the next one? Saturn opposite Saturn usually comes around this period, and then comes Neptune square Neptune, yes, and then finally, last but not least, lest we forget, comes Pluto square Pluto, yes, okay, what a bunch of gluck, you know, and we thought adolescence was bad, right? You get through this, you've really gotten through it, okay? It's quite obvious that these things attach very closely to these different stages of the midlife transition that we have discussed. And I think it's very clear. You can simply draw lines there, 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 and there. And it all works incredibly well. It's almost as if Murray Stein and Carl Jung had been reading up on their astrology before they proposed their ideas. At what age does Uranus opposite? I guess what we'll do now is to go through these and describe the ages they happen, and then try to add to the concepts we have here by amplifying them with our own knowledge of the planets that are obviously attached to these ideas. So, at what age does the Uranus opposition occur? No, actually, for those of you who are born, who is now having his or her Uranus opposition? And you're how old? 39, right. It can be as early as actually 37 in extreme cases. And it goes up to the age, for those who were born in 1900, it occurred at the age of 44. So it occurs somewhere between the age of 37 and 44. And it's interesting, by the way, I think the character of a generation can be largely determined by the age at which these happen, which varies widely from generation to generation. Anyway, so it occurs between 37 and 44. And of course, this is very closely aligned with the concept of separation, the break from societal restrictions and persona self-definition. It's very interesting because this, the planet Uranus is, I think, the major archetype that is tied in with the concept of the puer eternus that I described before, the Peter Pan concept of eternal youth. And so I think it's quite interesting that our Pluto in Leo generation gets this one first. We get Uranus opposite. Uranus is our first entry into the midlife transition. In fact, in my case, and this may be true in the case of some of you, I had a major insane thing that occurred to me when I had Uranus opposite Uranus, and I thought, oh, this must be my midlife crisis. And when it was over, I thought, well, I'm glad we're through with that. Now we're through with our midlife crisis. How many of you think you're through with your midlife crisis? Yeah, I was going to say, well, yeah, you're right, you better not raise your hand. But anyway, this is sort of the introduction. This sort of clears the stage. This is perhaps the overture to the midlife crisis. And nothing more than that. All it is it's just some lightning bolt strikes on your ego that allow you to see how brittle and how transparent all of that is. I remember when I was an astrologer of about 27 years of age, wise in my years of 27, and I had a client come who was about to go through his Uranus opposition, and I said, well, gee, that should be really interesting. I don't really know what that means, so why don't you come back next year and we'll see what it was. And he came back. His Uranus was in the fourth house. And when he had Uranus opposite Uranus at the age of 38 or 9 or so, he had this incredible fight with his landlord that ended up with him organizing a rent strike in his business, in his building, painting huge signs all over his building, rent strike, being taken to jail, having his business confiscated and totally changing his whole life. And after it was all over, he thought, gee, that was far out. I guess that's what Uranus opposite Uranus means. Needless to say, you look to see where Uranus falls in your chart. And where it is often where your Uranus opposite Uranus transition is going to be. I have Leo rising, so I got into an absolutely outrageously weird relationship. At one point, we were skydiving together, if that gives you any idea of how Uranian the whole thing was. And so you kind of look to see where that is in your chart. And that's apt to be the type of thing. But it is here in the issue, in the Uranus opposition that the issue of values first comes up. What is right? What is the right thing to do? And often in this crisis, which is real exciting and usually lots of fun in kind of a scary, freaky way like skydiving, you suddenly find that there is an ideal that you are pursuing. And that ideal perhaps has within it the key to the values that you will have to distill from this entire process in order to bring it to a close. So, that's the Uranus opposition. That is followed by the Saturn opposite Saturn, which occurs at what age? Who here is having their Saturn opposite Saturn?
42 to 45.
Age, please, is what, 42, pretty exactly, 42, give or take a bit, is the Saturn opposite Saturn.
44 for me.
It's 44 for you, so let's say 42 to 45. So early 40s, you have the Saturn opposition. Actually, this one's a relief after Uranus opposite Uranus. Yeah. This is a relief. This brings you back down to Earth and makes you think that everything is okay again. Because what happens is that it polarizes some Saturn reality outside of yourself. Usually it's often a battle with the father, a literal battle with the father that occurs at that age, or sometimes it's the death of the father. But there's certainly something that happens at that age that polarizes Saturn outside of yourself. And you say, oh, that's what the problem is. And as long as you see it outside of yourself, you think, well, this is great. I just have to deal with my father, or I just have to deal with the Democrats, or I just have to deal with the pro-abortionists, or something or other. And if I can just deal with them, everything will be okay. It is in this stage, when this is going on, that the greatest danger of defensive restructuring, that pasting the leaves back on the trees syndrome, is apt to manifest. It is then that you're most apt to see your problems outside of yourself as something that all I have to do is deal with that and we'll be okay. So that actually this one's almost a relief, because in between the thunderstorm of Uranus and the sifting fog of Neptune, to which we will shortly come, this seems like a point of dry land that actually seems straight. It's terrible. It's often a problem with health as well. But it's nice to have something real to worry about during this period. Have you noticed that? It's kind of nice to have something real to worry about when all this other stuff is going on. That is followed by Neptune square Neptune, which is, I think, the most regular of them all. It almost always comes exactly at the age of 42. This is because of the fact that Neptune has a nearly circular orbit. No?
40.
You're 40 and...
40,
you're having it 40, 41. So it's 40, 41, 42. But it's like, it's within a very narrow range of time. It's the most reliable one because Neptune has a nearly circular orbit as opposed to Uranus and Pluto, for instance. So anyway, so that this occurs, and this, of course, is closely associated with the concept of liminality. In fact, the whole mythology of Odysseus drifting at sea, as Jung said, drifting like a rudderless ship, taking an oar into the inland, everything is redolent with Neptunian symbology, direct Neptunian symbology. The concept of Poseidon and Neptune, of course, are the same. So that this is the time of drifting. And actually, the Saturn opposite, Saturn, is a happy distraction from this period of total drifting, of total unknown selfhood. This is the most difficult for a Western civilization man. After all, as Western civilization men, we all know where we're going and we all know how to get there. We just have to, you know, we just need time and we just have to get there. We're going to get something and we're going to get there, right? And all of a sudden we aren't going to get there. There's no there to get to. We're drifting around on this ocean being blown by these weird gods. So men have a really hard time with this, and they will deny it and project it and just have a wonderful time, do anything but accept this. There's a particular thing that happens here which was my own reaction, which I'm sure some of you can relate to. This occurred to me when the yuppies were in their ascendancy. Now, I, as perhaps some of you here, are a child of the 60s. And for someone who was born a child of the 60s to see the entire civilization glorifying conspicuous consumption of nonsensical nothings was absolutely the gravest disappointment of my entire life. I mean, here I had grown up on brown rice and buckwheat, and all of a sudden the only thing that I could get in my neighborhood was these gigantic plates with three peas arranged artistically in the center with an anchovy for $17.50. I couldn't even eat for 3 years. And in fact, this is rather typical of the Neptune square Neptune. There is a conflict of values. When the values of the present surrounding environment, symbolized by transiting Neptune, are in complete variance with your values, with the things that you believe in. And of course, the result of this is that you begin to assimilate your own values. No longer can you count on your values being reproduced on the television set or in your close group of friends. You suddenly have to define them and realize what they really mean. So this total isolation and alienation of values is very important for the successful transition into midlife. So, finally, we of course come to Pluto square Pluto. And this one occurs presently at the age of what? Who's the, I guess, youngest person here with Pluto square Pluto? Huh?
43.
43? 40. 37, okay. It can be as early as 37 and as late as 70. I think it's even more than that because Jung had his at the age of 78. So that due to the incredible eccentricity of the orbit of Pluto, the Pluto square can occur anywhere between the age of 37 and 78. Jung has had his at the age of 78. Those who were born in 1900 would have it at the age of 57. So this is what is really the variable. And it is, I think, extremely significant that our particular generation has all of these happening at the same time. I mean, lucky, lucky us. Is this what Pluto in Leo is really all about? Is that we get to have all of these at the same time? I think it is. And you don't really have to read very far in any newspaper to see the significance of each of us going through his or her midlife crisis in a conscious way before the whole planet goes down the tubes. When it transits the angles, they're even more interesting. So anyway, this is the journey to Hades and reintegration. As with all Pluto aspects, it boils beneath the surface for years and years and years, and then erupts like Mount St. Helens. And I think we've kind of described this fairly well. It's the introjection of the concept of death. And I should say that when I started on my midlife transition, it was precipitated by an accident that I had in Australia. I was hit by a car, and I was knocked out of my body. I was out there for 2 or 3 days before I managed to find it again. And after that, I've been in lots of car accidents. I have Sun Squared Mars, so it no longer is terribly interesting to me. I wake up in the hospital, and I say, oh, dear, what did I do this time? You know, here we are again, right? And so that's what I did, except this one was different. This one was unlike any of the others I've ever had before. And afterwards, I started having the most extraordinary dreams, which were the fertilization for this entire lecture. I started dreaming of funerals and corpses, and for 3 nights in a row, I buried a corpse of a different age. And I have never had dreams like this before, and I thought, this is really weird. Something is going on. And it was when I found that the second chapter of Murray Stein's book in Midlife is called The Burial of the Dead. I thought, there must be something going on here that is of significance to me. So let me stress that this introjection of the concept of your own personal death is an extremely important thing. And when it starts happening, if it hasn't occurred to you yet, you'll certainly know that it occurs. Now, do all these things occur right on time, like the transits that we astrologers in our defensive restructuring of the universe are so fond of saying, oh, well, this is 3:15, it must be time for my Neptune square Neptune. Do you think it happens that way? Of course not. No, of course not. It occurs at any time between these ages. That is to say that you can have all of these stages any time between 37 and 78. At any time, you can go through this whole thing. Because in our generation, it is so concentrated in the 40s, in the early 40s, it usually happens to us during that time. But there is what I have observed as the precipitating crisis. The precipitating crisis is an event that usually starts all this going. This happens inside of you. But it happens unconsciously. There are no conscious planets here. These are all external, you know, way out there planets. Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto are out there. They are not things you deal with every day. So the mere fact that these things, they all happen outside of you until something forces them inside. And the precipitating crisis is usually an aspect. Let's call that the PC here. The precipitating crisis is frequently an aspect of Uranus to the Sun or Moon. But it can be Uranus or any other of these planets, any outer planet to an inner planet. But frequently it is an actual aspect of Uranus to the Sun or sometimes Uranus to the Moon. And that brings all of this home. All of a sudden, these processes which have been going on an unconscious level for 5, 10, or 15 years, all of a sudden surface in a very conscious way. Is there someone here who had a precipitating crisis they can think of? Yeah.
I had Uranus conjunct Saturn in retrograde from my son's birthday last year. And I almost got a divorce. My business just about failed all at the same time.
Right. So this is the type of thing that occurs when that you need some aspect between these outer planets and the inner, something that will bring it home. And it can occur almost at any time between the age of, but all of a sudden this whole pattern that I've been describing then begins to unfold all at once because it has been going on unconsciously and viewed outside of yourself until then, and this aspect brings it in. So, let's try some examples in the little time we have left here. Actually, we have how long left? Almost 20 minutes. Let's try some examples here. Is that clear to everyone? Okay, this is the chart of a private person who I've named Janet. And she is a woman, and so we might expect this to be something of an awakening rather than a conquest type of thing. I have listed up here the times that the aspects occurred in her life, the age that she was at that time. She had transiting Uranus opposite Uranus in 1972 at the age of 41. The same year, she had transiting Neptune square Neptune, also 41. She then had Saturn opposite Saturn in 74 and 5, and that was at the age of 43. She finally didn't have Pluto square Pluto until 1979 and 1981. A chronology of things that happened to her during her midlife transition, and I think that hers was a very successful one, so it's a good example. In 1975, she decided she could not continue her marriage. Certainly, this is a separation of herself from her former identity as wife and mother. I mean, she had been a standard rescuing wife of an alcoholic husband, who was kind of a puer eternus and an author who didn't write very many books. And she worked and supported the family and raised their two sons. And finally, in August of 1975, she decided she could not continue her marriage. So she told her husband this, and he stopped drinking and changed his whole life, went into AA and did the whole thing. And things began to sort of improve. So that kind of occupied the whole period from 1972 to 1974. But during that time, she was in psychotherapy. That was, I suppose, her Neptune square, Neptune. Then in 1979, she had a station of Uranus, stationary, squared her sun. And between April and June of 1979, she quit her job and moved out from her house and ended her marriage. So that was the precipitating crisis. There had been a whole lot going on before then, but that was when it became conscious. And then finally, she went through Pluto square Pluto, having a very intense transference with her psychotherapist, and terminated her psychotherapy in 1981 after this very intense transference. She then began Rosen work and has now become a certified Rosen massage therapist, and converted the house that she got out of the divorce into a bed and breakfast, and so now supports herself completely. She's now an independent person who supports herself totally and completely. So that I think that this is a really good, very quick, obviously, example of a successfully terminated midlife transition. She's an absolutely lovely person. We can see in her chart that, of course, Uranus is in the seventh house, so it's not surprising that the marriage was the thing that focalized the whole thing. Pluto is in the 10th house, so it shows that among the major things that she's going to do in her life is to act as a therapist for other people, that she's sort of I think that anyone with Pluto angular is sort of a midwife of change for other people. They sort of help the new baby come out. I have it rising, I can tell you all about that. With Saturn on the IC, obviously her house and her family was the thing that she thought was the problem for a while, but then she realized that that was not the real problem outside, that there was a more significant problem inside. I'm sure you can see the other things in her chart that point out all of this. In fact, perhaps if someone here would like to comment on things you see in her chart that fit into the story that I've just told you. Yes?
She probably got married for the wrong reason.
I think Carl Jung or somebody said that everyone gets married for the wrong reasons. But of course, obviously, in this case, that obviously was the... Well, she was projecting a lot of herself outward. She found this wonderful puer eternus type of man who was... and he was taking care of her Uranus for her for a long time until finally she had to take it back in for herself. Yes?
In those years,
Yes.
we get through one cycle and go to the next cycle and go to the next cycle, where what's going on now is we're working together.
That's a very good point, so I'll repeat it for the tape, is that she's observed that in those years it was easier to have a successful integration because all the aspects didn't occur at the same time. You can have all these aspects now within a 2 or 3 year period, if you're really lucky. I don't think, though, that that's the case, because I've just described that you don't assimilate these at the time they happen anyway. But they are going on. It is intense. It is really, and it is, I think, easier for her. Other observations on this chart? Okay, let's try another one. Yes, I can try to do that. You can look at this chart here. Do you know who this is? It says it's Carl Jung. So, his story is really quite interesting. This, of course, is more of a conquest model, right? Because he is a man, and he was obviously doing that type of thing. We've already described, and of course this is described carefully in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, his own autobiography. But Freud started losing authority for him around 1909. He says the end of our relationship was already foreshadowed. In 1912 was his break with Freud, which was the precipitating crisis, which happens to be a station of Uranus opposite Carl Jung's sun. Now, Carl Jung's Uranus is again in the seventh house. His sun is exactly square Neptune and widely square Pluto. No, I guess not. And I guess Pluto's angular, though. So we can see here that the period of liminality occurred. After the parting of the ways with Freud, a period of inner uncertainty began for me. And he had these amazing dreams of floods and dead people and Switzerland and so forth. So I'll read you one later. In 1916 and 17, Jung wrote the Seven Sermons to the Dead, which are a very strange mystical statement of his Gnostic beliefs, and those are described by his Neptune square Neptune at that time. And in fact, perhaps I'll read you a couple of these dreams that Jung had, because they describe so perfectly the whole thing. There's a Neptune dream, which I think is absolutely perfect here, or a Neptune statement. See if this sounds like Neptune square Neptune. He wrote this in 1916. It was then that I ceased to belong to myself alone, ceased to have the right to do so. From then on, my life belonged to the generality. It was then that I dedicated myself to the service of the psyche. I loved it and hated it, but it was my greatest wealth. My delivering myself over to it, as it were, was the only way by which I could endure the existence and live it as fully as possible. So the whole concept of surrender of self to the very thing that has been haunting you, the taking of the oar inland, the ending of the trip on the waters of the psyche by acknowledging who you are, all of this was focused by his Neptune square Neptune. He didn't have his Pluto square Pluto until 1953, and I'm not quite sure why he had such a wonderful Pluto square Pluto dream in the 1913, but he did, so perhaps it was part of his Uranus function there. But this was the most wonderful dream of all. He had a dream that said, I was with an unknown brown-skinned man, a savage, in a lonely, rocky mountain landscape. It sounds like the beginning words to Dante's Inferno, doesn't it? It was before dawn. The eastern sky was already bright, and the stars were fading. Then I heard Siegfried's horn sounding over the mountains, and I knew that we had to kill him. But we were armed with rifles and lay in wait for him on a narrow path over the rocks. Then Siegfried appeared high up on the crest of a mountain in the first ray of the rising sun. On a chariot made of the bones of the dead, He drove at furious speed down the precipitous slope. When he turned a corner, we shot at him, and he plunged down, struck dead. Filled with disgust and remorse for having destroyed something so great and beautiful, I turned to flee, impelled by the fear that the murder might be discovered. But a tremendous downfall of rain began, and I knew that it would wipe out all traces of the dead. I had escaped the danger of discovery. Life could go on, but an unbearable feeling of guilt remained. When I awoke from the dream, I turned it over in my mind, but was unable to understand it. I tried, therefore, to fall asleep again, but a voice within me said, "You must understand the dream, and you must do so at once." The inner urgency mounted until the terrible moment came when the voice said, "If you do not understand the dream, you must shoot yourself." In the drawer of my night table lay a loaded revolver, and I became frightened. Then I began pondering once again, and suddenly the meaning of the dream dawned on me. Why, that is the problem that is being played out in the world. Siegfried, I thought, represents what the Germans want to achieve. This was 1913. To impose their will, to have their own way. Where there is a will, there is a way. I had wanted to do the same, but now that was no longer possible. The dream showed that the attitude embodied by Siegfried, the hero, no longer suited me. Therefore, it had to be killed. Heavy duty, huh? So, this is Carl Jung, his midlife crisis. We all know it came out fairly well. In the few remaining minutes, this chart has been a little bit adapted. There's one planet that I've changed in order that you won't recognize what the chart is. But first of all, let's see, is this chart going through a midlife crisis at the present time? Uranus in 8 degrees of Gemini, well, they just had Uranus opposition 4 or 5 years ago. Neptune 22 Virgo, they had that square not too long ago. Pluto in Cancer, they had the square not awfully long ago. Does anyone recognize this chart? It's the United States chart. The only thing that has changed is that Pluto ought to be in Capricorn instead of in Cancer. And I think it makes it very clear that the U.S. is going through a midlife a transition collectively. In fact, the actual dates of the transits were, if I can find them here in my notes. And think about all the things that are going on in the U.S. these days. The Uranus opposition occurred in 1983. Saturn conjoined Saturn in 1982. Neptune squared Neptune in 1981. And Pluto squared Pluto in 1982. So within a 2-year period, the U.S. had all of the transits of a midlife transition. And of course, that was the beginning of what will fondly be remembered as the Reagan years, while the next 3 centuries tries to pay for them. I think it's extremely interesting that the U.S. has gone through this midlife crisis. And finally, to conclude, there is this issue of values. Because what happens, I feel, and actually, if you'd like to see a real fine example of a midlife transition gone awry, look at the chart of Israel, born May 14th, 1948. They have their Uranus opposite Uranus in January 1987, Neptune square Neptune right now, Pluto square Pluto right now, and Saturn opposite Saturn in 1993. And we don't have to ask what's going on there. So, is there life after 40? Is there life after the midlife crisis? If you have avoided all of the pitfalls, Circe's attractions and Scylla and Charybdis and the whirlpools and the giants, then finally you get to move into individuation. You actually get to find out who you are. But then your work has only just begun, because you cannot simply leave society behind. Jung makes it very clear that it is not enough to find out who you are and leave society behind and go and build your own castle. You must contribute your knowledge to society. He says, "The man who cannot create values should sacrifice himself consciously to the spirit of collective conformity." What? Yes, he says that the man who cannot create values, should, ought to, sacrifice himself consciously to the spirit of collective conformity. In so doing, he is free to choose. Only to the extent that a man creates objective values of use to his society may he individuate. It remains a pose so long as no positive values are created. What he's saying here is that if you individuate, you separate yourself from society, but that is not allowed. You have to give the values that you have created back to society, as Jung did, as Joseph Campbell did, and as we hope the United States can do as our role of a leader in the world of the future.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
This is the end of this cassette. Please advance the tape as far as possible for the next playing.